Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here this morning. Our first case will be 11-1978, State of Ohio versus Benny Adams. For the appellant, Ms. Morrow.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Lynn Morrow, and along with John Juhas, we represent the appellant, Benny Adams. We would like to reserve 8 minutes of rebuttal time for Mr. Juhas to address the court. If Ohio is committed in implementation of the death penalty to ensure that those who are executed are the worst of the worst, if Ohio is committed in implementing the death penalty to ensure that those who end up on death row have gotten there through a procedure that is fair, that is designed to ensure that those who are there ended up there through a process that reliably determined that result, then Mr. Adams' conviction and sentence must be vacated.
Counsel, you've got 21 propositions in your brief. Most of those relate to the imposition of death and question various, or raise various legal issues related to that. If we were to conclude that there were problems with that part of the outcome here, could you focus for at least a period of time on the conviction itself? Because it seems to me you don't challenge the DNA, right?
Correct.
So that's just pretty hard to get around in terms of your defendant.
Certainly, Your Honor. The DNA that is present is evidence of some sexual conduct. The evidence of the murder, the aggravated murder, is circumstantial. And
well, but that's true many times, and certainly there was a good deal of testimony that's not challenged indicating that this gentleman had no relationship with her at all, and that, in fact, she feared him. So that would all be circumstantial in indicating that a rape occurred, correct?
Correct. And the issue of fear and the testimony that was presented on that issue, we submit, was presented to taint this jury, that the evidence regarding the murder was so tenuous that the only way they could get this jury to accept that circumstantial evidence was to improperly introduce these specific instances of other acts. Well, not excited utterances, not statements by Gina Tenney that she was afraid, but witnesses' interpretation that they thought she was afraid or that she was apprehensive. And that never should have entered into this courtroom based upon this court's prior rulings that excited utterances may be admissible, but the witnesses' basis for believing the victim was fearful should not have come in. And so that certainly tainted it. There was other evidence that was not properly before this jury. This was a 22-year delay in this prosecution that was reinstituted solely because a detective saw Mr. Adams walking along the street and realized he had been released from prison. There was no new evidence when Mr. Adams was arrested on October 3rd of 2007. The delay was prejudicial to this defendant because of the reasons set forth by the court in Luck regarding witnesses' memories.
Well, at the time that the murder happened, it wasn't possible to do the DNA analysis that occurred here. Is that correct?
That's correct, but the state of Ohio stipulated that at the time of this murder back in 1986, they had a very strong case against this defendant with significant, substantial scientific evidence to support a conviction. And they did not have the DNA evidence when they arrested him on October 3rd.
Well,
so the DNA did not play a part in why this case was reinstituted.
Counsel, didn't they, at the time she was murdered, put evidence before the grand jury on the receiving charge, and that did not result in an indictment?
That was on the receiving stolen property charge.
He had her television. He had her keys in his apartment in the wastebasket. He had her ATM card in the pocket of his coat.
And we have no idea why the grand jury no-billed that. None of the records from the grand jury, none of the witness testimony was available because there had been a fire.
But to say that they had a strong case, scientific and otherwise, in 1985 or 87, whenever, how can that be when they couldn't even get the receiving stolen property against him?
And excuse me, that's not me saying that. That was the state of Ohio stipulating to that, because the witnesses from BCI that had that information concluded that there was strong, significant scientific evidence that narrowed Mr. Adams to 4%.
4% of the population.
So the state of Ohio stipulated to that. And had there been a panel of jurors impaneled to fairly review this evidence and consider death, perhaps there would have been a different outcome here. The panel that was put together, the manner in which voir dire was structured, deprived appellant of a jury designed to fairly and impartially assess this evidence and determine death or some other sentencing option.
Well, counsel, what I'm driving at is you make a lot of points that are pretty good in your brief.
Thank
but,
you.
They relate to the imposition of death. And so my question is, we have to independently weigh, can't we just cure this by saying no death?
Certainly, if you look at the facts of this case under an independent weighing, the facts overwhelmingly support that the mitigating circumstances outweigh the aggravating circumstance here. And that certainly is an appropriate conclusion. But if we look at the genesis and the reason of having the jury trial, we can't say this verdict was reliably obtained based upon how this...
The verdict of guilty?
Yes. If we impanel a jury that is tainted, it's tainted for the guilt and not guilt phase as well as for the penalty phase. And this jury was tainted. It was not selected in a manner to fairly and impartially
and that,
review
evidence.
Is that
evidence. Because of the limitation placed on the voir dire by the trial judge?
That's one of the components, the limitation on voir dire, the failure to adequately voir dire on pretrial publicity, the judge cutting off witnesses when he didn't, I'm sorry, jurors when he didn't like their answers and instructing them that that wasn't appropriate. He did that in several instances. So there were a whole host of factors here that were set up so that we did not conduct voir dire in a manner to lay bare the foundation of jurors' views. We conducted voir dire in a manner to say, okay, we did voir dire. Now let's proceed to that mitigation step.
Ms. Morrow, you're challenging both the sentence and the conviction. And I think what I'm trying to find out here, of the 21 or so props that issues that you've raised with us, which are the ones that relate to the conviction itself? I mean, the idea of voir direing is all capital. Voir diring for a capital case and so on. What are the issues that specifically talk about the conviction? Not the sentence, but the conviction.
And I disagree with your premise that the concept of voir dire is for the sentencing phase. If we have a jury that is not fairly and impartially selected, you can't say that their verdict is reliably obtained. So the voir dire directly impacts both phases. We know from studies that a jury that is selected to be pro-death is pro-guilty. The studies on that are abundant and cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. But the other, to address your other issue, in addition to the voir dire procedures, we have statements of the defendant that were improperly admitted in violation of Miranda. We have items that were found from his home that were improperly seized without warrant from his vehicle, from his coat. We have failure of the trial counsel to file a motion to suppress eyewitness identification.
Let's talk about the items in the coat. The police were in his apartment. Was it his apartment or his friend's apartment?
It was his apartment that he shared with his girlfriend.
Right. And they were there because they couldn't get into the decedent's apartment, and they wanted to call the landlord, and they knocked on the door and asked to use the phone, right?
Correct. And that consent to enter...
And he allowed them to come in.
Yes.
And then while they're there making a phone call and not doing any search or anything else, he had told them he was there alone, and then they hear noises in the other room. And they find somebody for which there's an outstanding warrant, right?
Correct.
So we're still okay at that point.
We are not okay when the detective then takes Mr. Landers, who he has in cuffs, moves him to another room, picks up Benny Adams' coat, puts it on Mr. Landers, and then says, I'm searching this coat incident to arrest. Mr. Landers...
But is there evidence that the detective knew it wasn't... It's December, and they're going to take this guy for whom there was an outstanding warrant, they're going to take him down to the police station.
There is evidence.
And it's not unreasonable to try and find a coat for him before they take him out to the cruiser, right?
It's unreasonable to take him to another room, select a coat that's not his, when the detective is told that's Benny's coat. And in the suppression hearing on transcript page 142, the detective says, yes, Mr. Landers tells me that's Mr. Adams' coat. So I guess if we believe this is appropriate procedure, the detective could have walked him next to a dresser and said, oh, that's within his reach. I'm going to now search this dresser. Schimmel made clear in the United States Supreme Court that only those things within the immediate reach of the defendant.
Well, they were going to put a coat on him, and they wanted to make sure there was nothing in the pockets of that coat that they are going to have to deal with in the cruiser.
And under the Fourth Amendment, they don't have a right to do that because they knew it wasn't his coat. They picked
they
it up.
They knew it when they picked it up off the floor that it wasn't his coat?
Yes. As they were picking it up, Mr. Landers said to them, that's not my coat, that's Mr. Adams' coat.
Okay.
And if we assume they've checked to make sure there's no weapons, there's a welfare card and an ATM card, not anything that arguably could feel like a knife or a gun or any other type of weapon that would permit them to conduct
but
the search.
But this is all, the prosecutor and the police have all of this back in 1985.
Correct.
And they have the fact scenario as to how they acquired knowledge that this defendant had articles that belonged to the woman who lived upstairs who's been found floating in the river.
Yes. They wait 22 years.
Well, but they didn't have the DNA evidence then, and perhaps, I mean, I guess we no way of knowing, the prosecutor back then said, this stuff from the pockets might not be constitutionally admissible.
And we don't know why, because we have none of those records.
So that could explain why they didn't go forward at that time. They thought, we're pretty sure it's this guy is the perpetrator, but our best evidence here is the stuff we found in this coat pocket, and we're on thin ice here,
and that's
constitutionally.
And that's the same thin ice they were on when they arrested him. I'd like to make sure I keep some rebuttal time. I will say, of the jurors who sat on this panel, five of them admitted that they had read newspaper articles, saw TV, and had information about this case that was not properly voir dired to determine if that would influence how they assessed the guilt, not guilt phase of this trial.
They ultimately say, though, that they could follow the law and put aside what they had seen in the media?
What Morgan makes clear is getting a juror to simply say, I'll follow the law, isn't sufficient. Adequate voir dire to probe if that's actually accurate is, and that didn't happen here.
Counsel, may I take you down a different path while we're using your time here?
I would like to reserve
counsel,
the time.
Answer the questions yes. The court directs to you.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm looking at another assignment of error that troubles me, and I'm looking at the Court of Appeals at paragraph 334, and I'm looking at, I want to ask you directly, the Court of Appeals says that he killed her purposefully while committing, attempting to commit, or immediately after committing a rape, a robbery, a burglary, and a kidnapping is clearly established by the evidence. Did the jury ever find that to be true?
The way this specification was submitted to the jury, there was no unanimous finding as to any one of the aggravating circumstances.
How do I know that?
Because we have the jury instruction, we have the verdict forms, all the aggravating circumstances are lumped into the one charge, and we have the prosecutor arguing that you don't need to find it was rape, you don't need to find it was robbery. If you can find any combination of those, it doesn't need to be unanimous.
And how is that a trial of your peers then if they were relieved of that responsibility?
It is certainly not finding the necessary elements beyond a reasonable doubt and the unanimity that is required.
So you're saying that they had to unanimously find rape or they unanimously had to find the burglary or whatever the charge was, that several of them believing that it was a rape or one of the other charges, even though all of those charges would be the predicates for the capital offense is not sufficient in your that's your position.
It is not sufficient, and Ohio Revised Code Section 2941.14 requires that if there's more than one aggravating circumstance specified, it is to be in a separately numbered specification, specifically so the jury can decide that specification.
So the direct answer to my question is he's never been found guilty of rape, has he?
No, he has not.
Or burglary?
No, he has not.
Or kidnapping?
No, he has not.
So how are we going to affirm putting him to death?
We cannot. If there are no other questions, I will leave the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Rivera.
Counsel, I want to be present. I want to be conscious of your time. Could you answer that question I just asked? Can we affirm a death sentence if there's been no finding of a predicate offense?
Absolutely. And to answer your question specifically, the jury found beyond reasonable doubt that this defendant purposely murdered Gina Tenney while, specifically as it's worded, at least one of those predicate offenses were present.
I'm giving you that he was found guilty of murder. I fully understand that. But it seems to me that the United States Supreme Court has said in order to elevate to capital punishment, a jury must find a predicate offense. Am I wrong?
No, that is absolutely correct. And I would, in response to that, in their verdict, they found that those predicate offenses were present.
Plural?
Now, I'm sorry?
Plural? Offenses?
Yes. And I think the evidence suggests that. The way it's worded was worded according to the statute.
Counsel, you and I can agree. I have no problem with that. My question is, did this jury find him guilty of rape, burglary, or kidnapping? Yes or no would be the answer I'm looking for.
They found him guilty of at least one. And I think that's enough.
Which one?
Which is enough.
Which one?
The rape. I think there's overwhelming evidence.
This jury found him guilty of rape.
I definitely see the question. This court, what was done in this case is exactly what this court says is allowed. And the state did exactly what this court has set forth.
In which case? Which case should we look at to see
the specifically Davis and Johnson. I believe one was in 2006, one in 2008. And I will say that the facts were the difference between Johnson and Davis and Mr. Adams' case was the statute of limitations had not run on the predicate offenses. So you do have those convictions. However, the same argument was raised in those cases regarding the jury instructions, basically informing the jury or instructing the jury that you merely need to find the presence of one predicate offense pursuant to the aggravated murder
and
conviction.
And we've approved that. I thought in most cases you had separate specs.
Yes. In those cases, you do have those separate specs. Well, I believe you had the separate specs. I know you definitely had the underlying predicate offenses. However, this court still went on to hold that, or I should say, it never found error in the jury instruction itself. It never said the jury instruction is error, but there's no prejudice because we have these separate findings. That was not in this court's opinion.
The problem you have here is that whether it was rape, burglary, or kidnapping, the statute of limitations had expired by the time he went to trial.
Correct.
And so you didn't have those in the other cases. And we do have case law that says if there's several aggravating circumstances, there doesn't have to be a conclusive finding by the jury as to which one, because any of them will support the finding of guilt.
Correct.
But in this case, you've got the added complicating factor that these aggravating circumstance case or crimes, it was too late to prosecute them.
That's correct, and that's why they were dismissed.
Okay, so if you don't have the underpinnings, how do you support the capital finding? You can support a finding of death, you know, that he killed her, you know, but not the aggravating circumstances without those being convictions of reality. And what's your position on that?
I think the way this was structured and the fact that the state proceeded on one specification, I'll submit that it's sufficient, and his death sentence should be affirmed on this basis that the jury unanimously found at least one of those predicate offenses was present. And I think
so you're saying you don't need a conviction, you just have to have that
finding,
activity.
That finding, yes.
Where is that? What's your support for that?
I think that's the plain, the plain language of the statute. The death specification is worded in the same manner as the aggravated murder statute, where it calls for, it's worded in the or, you need the presence of one or the other. Specifically state, a specific one under a specific
specification. It doesn't say you have to have a conviction for rape, kidnapping, murder, or any of the other crimes in order to lead you to the murder is then sufficient to be characterized as a capital offense.
I think the verdict forms show that he was convicted of those offenses.
Wait a minute. How could he be convicted of the offenses if they were statute of limitations precluded that?
Misstated that. He was convicted of the aggravated murder, clearly, with those predicate offenses
being present but not convicted?
Being elements of those offenses, yes. And the same thing with the specification.
So we're talking about the felony murder specification here that elevates something to a capital case. Your position is that you don't have to have a separate conviction for a felony to support the felony murder conviction specification?
The state is left with what it's left with based on the passing of time.
I mean, in a normal case, you would have a separate conviction for one of these felonies, and you would have the felony murder specification, correct?
Presumably, yes.
Okay, so we would be going into new territory to say when you have a passage of time like this, you don't need a separate conviction to support the felony murder spec.
Essentially, and I will admit that this case is unique, and it does differ from the previous cases.
Well, it's complicated further, isn't it, by the fact that the jury in a verdict form was not asked to specifically say which felony was proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
And that's correct. And I think, and as I stated earlier, that's based on this court's case law that that one, either or, is sufficient. They do not have to find, all 12 do not have to find the exact predicate offense.
But that's a different situation, because in cases like that, we also had the evidence related to a separate conviction for the separate felony.
Essentially.
So there's kind of a bootstrap on top of a bootstrap here that we're talking about.
Somewhat.
Counsel, I want to take you back to, if we were to strip away the evidence found in the coat, say you don't have that, the jury still got the DNA, right?
Correct.
I'm focusing now on the finding that he committed the murder. They've got the DNA. They've got a variety of witnesses who, in a variety of ways, established that it is highly improbable that there was consensual sex between the defendant and the victim. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
How many witnesses would fill that bill whose testimony is not being challenged here? The appellant is challenging everybody's testimony, but taking away the coat, what do you have left?
Taking away the coat.
Yeah, absolutely. Or the evidence found in the coat.
Yes. Absolutely. Taking away the coat, you have, we'll start with the question on her statements of fear and her excited utterances. You had, I believe, a minimum of three witnesses: Mr. Robinson, Ms. Sergeff, the victim's mother, and I believe the ex-boyfriend. I believe that was four. Four witnesses testified to those statements in various aspects. And I'll also throw in, they did not just testify to her statements. They testified to several firsthand observations that they personally made.
And you had the break-in, right?
Or
to her apartment before her death.
Yes, their personal observations were how the defendant engaged them in conversations, stared out the window, things like that. The card, the changing of the telephone number, those are firsthand observations. Those are not hearsay statements. You have the coroner's testimony of finding of that she was killed in with a combination of smothering and strangulation. You have the evidence on her where you have the ligature marks on her neck that was consistent with the cord that they found in her vehicle that was parked back at the apartment the morning that they arrived after she was found floating in the river. Going on to the car, you have the two witnesses, Sandra and John Ali, who testified that they saw the defendant at the ATM the previous night. I believe it was John Ali that testified to recognizing the sound of Gina's car. They identified, they put the defendant in her car that night.
Right.
And I'll say, without finding the card, the bank confirms that there was an attempt on her card that night. The witnesses put defendant there at that time attempting that card. So
right.
That's still assuming that they don't have the physical card in his possession. They still have that evidence.
So you would, I want to lead you here. You would argue that you still have a strong case if we said you can't, you couldn't use the evidence that was found in his apartment in that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was it was a piece of evidence. It was an important piece of evidence, but it was a small piece of evidence compared to what was left. And
did they have all of these other things back in 85?
They had most Essentially, yes, in different states. I mean, things came in at different times, but yes, they had all these physical items. And just to try to answer your question, because there was a multitude of evidence presented in this case, unrelated to the card, they obtained a consent search from his girlfriend, who lived in the apartment with the defendant. That's where they found Gina Tenney's TV, which the defendant's fingerprint was found on the television. They found her vehicle keys, apartment keys, in his trash can. They also found a pot holder in his apartment that matched her pot holder. That is the pot holder that they found hair strands.
And this is subsequent to executing a search warrant.
Yes, and this kind of ties into the speedy trial argument, but when he was arrested, the only piece of evidence that they had when he was actually arrested was the ATM card. That is it. Everything else was discovered or produced at some later time. The last piece of evidence was the blood evidence, which in 1986 it only narrowed down to 4%, and then obviously in 2007 they have the DNA evidence.
Do you have any way of knowing why the prosecutor decided not to go forward in 1986?
I think he testified that in his belief, in his discretion, he did not think it was strong enough or would produce a guilty verdict at that point in time based on the evidence. And as the county prosecutor at that time, you know, he made that judgment
right.
call. And I think tying that into their the undue delay, you know, that seems to be a reasonable judgment. And getting into that argument, you only get to whether that judgment call was reasonable if they could first establish prejudice, actual prejudice that he was suffered. And I think it's clear in this case that they threw out a lot of arguments, a handful of arguments, but there was no actual finding of any type of prejudice.
Well, he went to prison on other charges.
That's correct, at that time.
In the same county?
Yes.
So the prosecutor who's making a decision here knows I've got a better case against him on something else.
Essentially,
but that
yes.
was afterwards. That wasn't the same time, was it? Not the subsequent rape that he did 18 years on had not been committed at the time he killed this victim.
I believe it had.
It had?
Yes. It occurred prior to Gina Tenney's murder. I believe he was arrested. He was arrested for a handful of things. He was arrested on the ATM card shortly after. He was on probation. He was violated and held on that. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he was indicted on the other rape shortly after. I think it was January 10th, according to my notes.
Okay.
Could we move to the rehabilitation issue? What is the state's position? The defendant's counsel talks about the activities of Mr. Adams after he was released from prison and argue that that is a significant mitigation for any kind of weighing of mitigating factors.
I would agree that defendant's rehabilitation is his strongest argument. However, I don't think it comes close to outweighing the aggravating circumstance in this case. Sure, he went to prison. It's undisputed that he was a model inmate during his time in prison. However, I don't think that's enough compared to other death penalty cases. You have other mitigating factors which may weigh against the conviction, such as a deplorable family history, mental illnesses, things of that nature. But the fact that Benny Adams had the opportunity to basically thrive in prison is not enough. He essentially had an opportunity that's rare. And he only had this opportunity because of another horrific crime. And I don't think I don't think he should be rewarded.
You know, what's the opportunity that's rare? I'm not understanding that.
Well, the fact that in a death penalty case, a defendant can come and tell a jury, they could say, and often are, you know, prison, a life sentence is an appropriate punishment because, you know, he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison, and that's enough. Benny Adams, it was rare because he actually got to tell a jury, hey, I've been in prison for a couple decades, and I was a model inmate, as opposed to saying I'm going to be a model inmate. I mean, I would say it's rare that any defendant can tell a jury that, hey, I behave in prison for 20 years. I'm a model inmate. And I think that's what I was speaking to a rare occurrence.
It seems like a pretty weak sales pitch to a jury, but
I think that's their strongest argument, but because there was nothing else. There really was nothing else. He had the family history. There was nothing that stuck out. They spoke about him being a good father. Nothing of a deplorable upbringing, like we see in other cases.
He was out how long?
Two or three years, I believe.
Right, and he's somewhere. Back in prison now, I assume.
Yes. It was. I believe it was two. I think he was released in somewhere around 2004, and went back in 2007. So somewhere around the 3 year range. If I could shift my focus to the first assignment regarding the voir dire, I think this record show, or as the 7th District recognized, this voir dire, it lasted 3 days. It encompassed over 800 pages. And to isolate a defendant's argument and say they only had 4 minutes per juror, I think is a bit of a stretch. They had a group of five, sometimes more. They had an hour. Each side was allocated 20 minutes. That includes the court, the defense, and the state. They only voir dire these jurors on pretrial publicity and their views on the death penalty. That is it. This court had a separate general voir dire, as you would in any other criminal case, afterwards, once they eliminated all the jurors that could not serve on this jury.
Were there jury questionnaires in advance of?
Yes, there was.
Available,
yes.
To defense?
Yes, and the 7th District, I believe, they characterized them as extensive juror questionnaires. And it's hard to pick out one page, but taking the voir dire transcript as a whole, you could see how the trial court basically handled the pretrial publicity. It asked, has anybody heard of this case? And the members who have heard of the case, he was careful in not allowing them to go into details to find out those details in front of the other jurors. He took those aside and did those in chambers. So essentially, the court started out each at the beginning of each panel, discussed the pretrial publicity, did away with that, and some panels, it was a very short time. That left defense and the state to focus solely on their views on the death penalty, or if they had other further questions regarding pretrial publicity, which there was very little. It left them time to focus on one issue. So this individual voir dire essentially was narrowed down to one issue, and that's their views on the death penalty, and that's it. They had an adequate opportunity to ask them a number of questions, anything obviously regarding their views on the death penalty and the pretrial publicity, which in this case were the two most important issues.
Counsel, what about the allegation that the judge was intimidating the jurors when they wanted to speak freely about their feelings about the death penalty and reservations they had about the ability for them personally to impose a death penalty? And the statements that are contained in the record indicate the judge admonished them that it is their responsibility to do this, but in a way that maybe was, again, intimidating. What's your position on that?
I think it's hard to read from the record that he was actually in, you know, physically intimidating the jurors.
I didn't say physically.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry. Intimidating the jury with his, I mean, not physically in the sense, but with his words. The Seventh District, I think, properly recognized that he was, the trial court was simply explaining the law to the jurors. And I, you know, if you know, reading through the transcript, you'll see that a number of jurors, they come in and they have, you know, general, you know, yes, no against the death penalty. They have reservations. They may be for the death penalty, but they themselves do not want to actually impose it. I think that the Seventh District, and I would adopt their view that, that he, the trial court was merely explaining the law to these jurors. And I think the juror in question was juror 82. This particular juror indicated that he was in favor of the death penalty in his questionnaire, but he was hesitant to actually impose the death penalty himself. I would advocate that this juror was actually more beneficial to the defendant because he at least raised reservations about imposing the death penalty or not being able to sign the actual death verdict himself. And he was actually, if anything, weighed in favor of the defense rather than the state. And that's the reason why the state moved to challenge this juror for cause, and the court overruled the state and said, no, this juror, I explained the law to this person. He stated that he would follow the law. I believe him.
Counsel, did you try this case?
No, I did not.
So you've had to go over an extensive record. The appellant's brief is extensive in it. And they're suggesting ineffective assistance of counsel at trial. If you weren't there, it's tougher to do that off of a record. But if I'm remembering the appellant's brief correctly, failure to object to some of this testimony about the fear from the witnesses.
That's correct.
That you... And that's there was no objection by counsel. Is that correct?
At the time of trial, there was no objection. However, I'll say most of these issues, and these including her statements, were pre-tried, were addressed at a hearing before trial. There was a hearing. Or there was a motion in limine hearing regarding these statements, her fear, her excited utterances, and most of the issues were litigated, argued before trial, but there was no follow-up objection at the time of trial.
The defense counsel at the time objected based on hearsay to these
before trial
in a hearing before the judge, and the judge said, I've reviewed this, don't believe it violates the hearsay rules, and I'm going to let it in.
Correct.
All right.
And I believe, and that's true to just about every issue that counsel raised here as ineffective assistance. Essentially, all of them were raised in some aspect. There was probably not many proper objections at the time that the evidence or testimony came in, but in some form or fashion, it was discussed or it was litigated and essentially objected to at some point.
Was the search that resulted in the finding of the credit card in the jacket pocket the subject of a motion to suppress?
Yes. Yes, there was. Yes, there was a hearing where they addressed that specific issue.
And if the testimony then came out during that suppression hearing that Horace indicated it was not his jacket but rather belonged to Adams.
That's correct. And I believe the testimony suggests that happened essentially simultaneously. They were picking up the jacket, searching it, and that's when he said, that's not my coat, it's the defendant's.
Had the coat been put on him, or had he been handcuffed?
No, I don't think so, because I mean that was the whole point of searching the coat was to check for weapons before they placed the coat.
Was he sleeping at the time he was arrested? Was he clothed?
I believe he did not have a shirt on. From my recollection, I believe he did not have a shirt on. So he had pants on. That was it. I don't think he was awake in the sense that when they went and found him, he was, I believe, standing upright.
All right, and so what is your response to Ms. Morrow's position that it was an improper search? What is the state's view of that?
I think the search of the coat was a proper search incident to an arrest. They were clearly arresting Horace Landers. They, upon seeing him, they immediately knew he had an outstanding warrant. The case law regarding search incident to arrest focuses on one simple question. Could the suspect gain access to the area that the police,
The proximity of the coat to the suspect at that point in time?
I believe the detective testified to 3 to 4 feet. That's why it was 3 to 4 feet. They were about to go outside. It was January 30th. At a minimum, he had a T-shirt on, and that was it. I believe when they first found him, he did not have a shirt on at all. They were simply they're going to pick up the first coat that they found, place it on him to take him outside. And the witnesses, the witness that found her body testified that it had just snowed the night before. So obviously it was quite cold outside.
Counselor, I guess I'm having trouble incident to a lawful arrest. I will agree with you that if they were searching his blue jeans to see if there was a weapon in his blue jeans, that would be permissible, correct?
Correct.
But is your position that the police incident to a lawful arrest may search your best friend's jacket?
Well, they may search a jacket or a piece of clothing that they are putting on the suspect as they are.
Even if they're told it does not belong to that suspect.
That was done at the same time. And I'll go one step further. Even if it didn't belong to that suspect, if they still intended to put the coat on him, because let's say that was the only coat around, I think it would still be reasonable because the coat is going with the suspect in the car. He clearly still has access to that jacket while he's in police custody. And that is the focus of a search incident to arrest, not necessarily whether he's handcuffed, but whether he still has access to that area. And clearly, the jacket going on him, he had access to it.
To follow that logic to its logical conclusion, could they then go into the closet and find a warmer coat and search it before they put it on him?
I think that would be a stretch.
Why?
To obtain a warmer coat?
Sure.
I think if the defendant requested a warmer coat, I think that would be reasonable.
And I would agree with you.
Counsel, did the owner of the coat, Mr. Adams, say, "That's my coat, don't give it to him, don't use it, you can't touch it"?
No, there was no testimony, and I don't recall if the defendant was
he wasn't even in the back bedroom where they were.
I don't think he saw that going on at the time.
All right, so the coat's on the floor, they pick it up. They're going to use it. Nobody said you can't use the coat for this guy. He says, though, Landers says, "It's not my coat." At that point, you know, the police were only interested in effecting the arrest, getting him out to the car, and putting a jacket on him.
Correct.
Which could have then been returned to its rightful owner once he's at the station, so it wasn't an attempt to deprive the owner of his coat.
No. And I see that I'm out of time. If there are no further questions, I would just rest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Juhas, you've saved about 13 and a half minutes.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. let me address first, if I may, some of the last questions that were asked when we're talking about the coat. There was testimony that it was 3 to 4 feet away, but that was after the detective walked him into the back room and then said the guy's 3 to 4 feet away. And so obviously, we made some reference in our brief to the Gantt decision, which came out. That obviously wasn't the law at the time that this took place, but Schimmel was the law. And Schimmel said that it was reasonable to search in the area to protect for weapons. Justice Pfeiffer.
But if they're going to put the coat on the defendant to take him to the car, you would agree checking the pockets to see if there's a weapon in it, so they're not carrying a weapon into the police car, is an eminently reasonable thing to do.
I would agree that's a reasonable thing. And I think while we're talking about reasonableness, we should really try to visualize what was going on here. Horace Landers is 5'8" tall. Benny Adams was 6'2" tall. It wouldn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that that wasn't Horace Landers' coat in the first place. In the second place, as Justice Pfeiffer mentioned, it was December when all this happened. We don't know how Horace Landers got there, but it's reasonable to assume that he didn't come shirtless in December. And so it would be just as reasonable for the police to say, Horace, we're placing you under arrest because you have an outstanding warrant. Would you mind telling us where your jacket is because it's December and you don't have a shirt on?
What are the practical implications for police officers under those circumstances? They have to have a dialogue with the defendant to say, which one is your coat? Do we need to go in another room and get your coat? If there's one lying there on the floor, why would it not be reasonable for them to just pick it up?
Well, with all due respect, it wasn't lying there on the floor. It was in another room.
But and a few feet away.
Pardon me?
But a few feet away.
Well, sure, but I don't know that we're imposing a terrible burden on police officers. They weren't even there to arrest the guy. So fine, you find a guy who's there, you recognize that he has a warrant for his arrest, it's December, you're going to be compassionate enough to say, I'm going to let this person go out with a coat. I don't see that there's any undue burden on the police to say, Mr. Landers, it's cold, you don't have a shirt on, would you mind telling us where your coat is?
Well, now you make You've both made a point of this other room. They came, knocked on the door, came in, asked to use the phone, the police.
Yes, sir.
And did that. And in the process, and I don't know why there was a conversation that the defendant said, I'm here by myself, and then they hear a commotion in the next room, and I think any reasonable person would be a little concerned at that point. They go into the next room. Was that a bedroom?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. So they go into the bedroom, find him hiding behind the door, this guy who's shirtless. And then you say, well, but they moved him to another room. Presumably, if he ran in the bedroom and hid when there's a knock on the door, he didn't take his coat with him.
Correct.
So it doesn't seem that unreasonable that as they're planning to take him out to the cruiser, they move back to the living area space, and there's a coat laying on the floor, to conclude that's probably his coat. That doesn't seem that unreasonable.
But I think we're talking about reasonableness, and we're talking about two men here. Obviously, if the police come to my house in December and say, we have a warrant for your arrest, it's cold outside, they might say, which coat is yours as opposed to your wife, so that I don't have to wear something out that's fluffy. I don't think it's unreasonable. We're not talking about an entire search here.
Well, I don't know. I've seen a lot of perk walks. I think they might get a kick out of putting you in something fluffy.
You may be right about that, Your Honor.
let me ask you about the search warrant. That was contested as well.
There was no search warrant. The warrantless search was contested.
No. Later on, there's a search of his apartment, right?
That all happens flowing out of the whole Adams incident.
Well,
of going into the apartment.
They get permission from the girlfriend to search the property or the subsequent to that.
That's why there's no warrant, because
okay,
they...
So they do that subject to permission from the girlfriend.
Yes.
And that occurred how much later?
It's sometime later that day. I don't remember exactly how long, but
there's an argument before the judge prior to trial about the propriety of the evidence obtained.
Yes.
Pursuant to consent from the girlfriend.
Yes. And the coat, of course.
Well, yeah, I understand. I'm trying to lay the code aside because I've asked the state, what else do you have if we say the evidence out of the coat shouldn't have come in? Is there still a case? That's what I'm driving at.
The keys were found in the apartment. They would find those pursuant to the consent. The potholders were found in the apartment. They would find those pursuant to the consent. The television was found in the home, and they would find those.
And are you contesting today that those items were improperly obtained and should not have been testified to?
Only to the extent that the consent arises out of the improper search. Everything flows from the coat. In other words, why are you asking for a consent to search the apartment except for the fact that what you found in the coat now wants you to search the apartment?
So to put a finer point on that then, you think everything else flows from the coat?
Yes.
So if we agree with you on the coat, you think all of the conviction is gone entirely?
Well, I don't know that I can say the conviction is gone entirely, because as Justice Pfeiffer says, they still have the forensic evidence, whether it's the later DNA or whether it's the secretor, non-secretor blood type evidence they had back in 85. There's still some evidence.
So what's the remedy then? You think it goes back?
I think it goes back. I think it goes back not only because of the search issue. I think it goes back, and I appreciate what the court has had to say in its questions about the death penalty issue and distinguishing that from the guilt and innocence. But I think Ms. Morrow is quite correct, and that is when you have a situation, and aside from the death penalty, and if I get time, I'd like to address a couple of the Morgan things. But aside from the death penalty, you've still got the issue of jurors, and I believe of the panels, all but either one or two of them, there was information. I have to respectfully disagree with my colleague when he says that Judge Franken pulled them aside into another room. That's not the case at all. He's asking them in front of the other jurors, what did you hear? And so if Justice Pfeiffer is one of the jurors and he's saying, well, here's what I read in the newspaper, and Chief Justice O'Connor has not heard any of that, now, of course, she's heard what Justice Pfeiffer has to say. And no one is taking the time to even say, well, Chief Justice O'Connor, now that you've heard those things about the fact that they suspect them in 85 and all those other things, does that change your opinion? Do you have a predisposition as to whether or not Mr. Adams might be guilty?
Was this voir dire conducted in panels of three or five jurors at a time?
It was largely conducted in panels of five. And when I say largely, it was designed to be conducted in panels of five. One of the things we've complained about is this numbering system and some confusion. There appears to be a couple of panels where there were as many as seven or eight.
Did counsel for Mr. Adams object to this procedure?
It being as candid as I can from the record as I glean it, and I was not trial counsel either, it appears that there was some unrecorded objection in chambers. And when I say that, there doesn't appear to be anything on the record. There doesn't appear to be any written filing. There is a reference to the fact that I know how counsel feels about this because we've talked about it, but that's not done on the record. It appears to be subsequent to a chamber's conversation. So that's the most that was done in that. One of the reasons that we've asserted the ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to challenge that procedure on the record.
Counsel, let me just clarify something. If we find that the police search of the jacket was unconstitutional, they don't have an ATM card, you're saying they would not then have gone to, if they hadn't had that ATM card, they would not have asked the girlfriend who was the tenant on the lease for the apartment to come back and do a consensual search?
I think that's so, yeah.
So they wouldn't have found the keys, the TV, and the potholder. And had they not had all of that, they wouldn't have really gotten to his DNA, would they?
That's correct.
So you're saying the DNA evidence would not have been there.
Right, which is why we're saying everything flows from the
code. Okay. So there would be no cause to arrest him.
Correct.
So there would be no cause subsequently to do a more sophisticated DNA test. And yet you're saying this should go back for a new trial.
Well, I'm sorry, maybe I didn't understand what the court, if all of those things are out, then there's probably an insufficiency. But if the court doesn't find that, I guess what I was trying to distinguish was it seemed to me the court was going in the direction of, well, if we vacate the death penalty, isn't that enough for us to resolve this case? And I was trying to answer that question by saying, no, there are other fundamental errors that occurred in the guilt and innocence phase.
Okay, if but all let, of let's, those things, let's go along the route that we find that the police officers were justified in ultimately locating that card in the pocket, and the search with the other evidence found, the DNA and the subsequent sophisticated DNA test, that was all good. Where are we? And we find, you know, the tainted voir dire process or, you know, something other. That, you're advocating, goes back then.
In my view, that goes back. May not win on a sufficiency, obviously.
Right.
But
the vacation of the the conviction is linked to the ATM card. And then your other argument is obviously that there's mitigating evidence that would negate the imposition of the death penalty here.
Correct. I think that I'd have to disagree with what Mr. Rivera said in terms of, well, he had an opportunity that nobody else has. You folks have obviously seen more death penalty cases than I have. Sure, we can talk about the ones with the bad upbringing and all that. That sort of explains why they got to where they are. But in this case, if what we're supposed to have is a genuine narrowing of the class of offenders eligible for the death penalty, and then assuming we constitutionally get there and we have a finding of guilt, then there has to be a further narrowing to say, is this a person who is among the worst of the worst? How do you draw that conclusion? Because you have a guy who goes to prison as a young man, who comes out as a middle-aged man, and if our prison system is designed to do something in terms of rehabilitation, Mr. Adams' case seems to be a pretty good success story, because he comes out, he can't even drive, so he's walking every place to find a job. He finds a job, he works as much overtime as he can, he's helping his mother, who he hasn't been able to help for the last number of years that he's been in prison. He's helping his daughter and his grandchildren, and he's even saying, for heaven's sakes, don't make the mistakes that I've made. I don't know how we can say that is the worst of the worst.
Although, counsel, that's not what the statute is saying. I know we've used that phrase has been used several times, but the statute talks about weighing the mitigation evidence against the aggravating factor that the jury has found, and we're talking about the felony murder specification, correct?
It does, Justice Lanziger, but the review statute also talks about and whether death is the appropriate penalty. And that's, I think, where you get to the issue of, in terms of statutory implementation, that's where I think you get to the issue of the worst of the worst. It's easy, I suppose, in any of these cases to say, my God, this was a horrible crime, to do what we think the judge did, which is actually take the nature and circumstances of the crime and use them as the aggravator when he talks about you coveted Gina Tenney and you coveted her possessions and that's why you did this. So it's easy to take any of these cases and say the facts are horrible and that weighs in favor of the death penalty, but it's also important to take those other factors, and when you're doing an appellate review, to say, and despite the heavy weight of what happened to this poor young girl, is it appropriate to give this person the death penalty? Is he irredeemable?
Well, the statute is just counter to what you've said. We look at the nature and circumstances of the offense as mitigating, not aggravating.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree that's how it's supposed to be. And in fact, if you look at the trial court's opinion and if you look at the trial court's pronouncement during sentencing, he professes to say, well, I find nothing mitigating about the nature and circumstances of the offense, but then he goes on to use those without saying so. He goes on to use those circumstances as aggravators and as reasons to impose the death penalty.
Counsel, your red light's on, but I want to come back to the consensual search. And you indicate that they're there because of the what was found in the coat pockets.
Yes, sir.
And that may be true. I mean, it's a long time ago, and it's probably nobody really remembers, but isn't it, given what you know now, what developed, that they would have been back there wanting to take a look, just based on the conversations that they would have had immediately as the investigation unfolded with her friends, with her ex-boyfriend, and those kinds of things.
You're talking about the utterances.
The defendant here would have certainly come into focus without what was found in the coat pockets.
That's true. And I guess it's calling for sure speculation. It's obviously easy to look in hindsight and say, well, there's all this evidence and they would have found it. But we don't know enough about the circumstances of the consent. For example, I can see one thing where somebody comes to Miss Fidelia and says, you know, there are three of this murdered lady's friends who are saying that your boyfriend was, you know, a little crazy about her and stalking her. We'd like to search your apartment. And she might say, get out of here. What are you talking about? Versus, listen, we just found this murdered lady, and in your boyfriend's coat, we found her ATM card and her welfare card. We want to search your apartment. Yeah, go right ahead. So I appreciate what you're saying, but it would be sheer speculation, and I can see a circumstance where there might or might not be consent depending upon what was presented at the time. I know I've exceeded my time. I thank you for your patience.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decisions. Thank you.